Support for the show comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes, buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
Support for this show comes from Mercury. There's an art to making the complex feel simple. Everything should be in sync so that even the smallest part serves a bigger purpose. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so ambitious companies have the precision, control, and focus they need to perform at their best. Apply in minutes at mercury.com.
Hello, welcome to Zuclunch on the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today is a special crossover Weeds EK Show episode, a post-debate special. Matt Iglesias and I talk about both the debate that the Democrats had the other night in Iowa and the debate, I think in some ways more importantly, they did not have, which was a more interesting debate. And so we end up getting pretty deep into some of the differences between the Joe Biden theory of politics and the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren theories of politics. So I think this is a fun conversation. Quick notes, the book tour is beginning to sell out, which is great. Thank you all for all of you who are coming. But we're now sold out in San Francisco, in DC, in New York, in Brooklyn. But if you are in Portland, in Boston, in Seattle, in Los Angeles, go to whywerepolarized.com or ezraklein.com to sign up for those dates. And of course, please pre-order the book. And I'll be releasing more dates in more places very soon. So stay tuned for that. But here I am talking about the debate with Matt Iglesias.
So we're going to talk about the debate, the state of the campaign, and some of the debates that didn't really happen. But first, I mean, we should talk about what did happen up there on the stage, in which it seemed like the big headline takeaway was that a slightly nasty brewing controversy between Warren and Sanders got nastier. And it's a little hard for me to say what it's about. Exactly.
I'll say what it's about. So there's a CNN article that came out now a couple days ago that reported that sources close to Warren, basically, or so it seems anyway, say that there was a conversation between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren where Bernie told Warren, again, according to sources in the room, although who it is sourced to is a little bit unclear in the story. According to sources in the room, Bernie said a woman cannot win the presidency in 2020. And this comes out in the CNN story. Bernie Sanders denies it flat out. He says, I would never say that. You can see me on television saying a woman can win the presidency. I've said that for a long time. And he makes the point, which I think is a reasonable point, that, look, Hillary Clinton won more votes than Donald Trump in that election. So how could you possibly even – how can anyone believe a woman couldn't win the presidency? But Warren's team releases a statement from Warren later that night on the day of the story break saying – nope, she stands by that. She does not really want to talk about this. This is not a thing that she thinks should be a huge issue. But that is what Bernie said. I was not in the room, and it is very hard to know what is happening. It is notable that Warren is holding the story. She is not saying, oh, there's probably a misinterpretation or something here. My gut on what happened here is that human beings communicate unclearly with each other, and Bernie probably said something that in his mind was more like Donald Trump will run a sexist, misogynistic campaign against a woman that will make it harder for her to win. And the way he said it or the way it was heard by Warren was a woman can't win. But then there's this whole meta issue about why is this coming out now? This is a more than year-old conversation. Why is it being leaked right before Iowa? And it has blown up the alliance, the pact, the non-aggression pact between Bernie and Warren.
One thing that I think is noteworthy is that to me, it seemed like something broadly similar happened. There was a moment when Warren nearly caught Joe Biden in the polls. And one thing that I thought might have happened at that point is that left-wing people in general, or left-wing like thought leaders, got behind Warren. They could have been like, this is great. Joe Biden's not going to be the nominee. Someone who's for Medicare for All is going to be the nominee. Somebody who wants to take on billionaires is going to be the nominee. And some people did say that, but there was a heavy contingent of the Bernie internet that took Warren's potential taking of first place as an existential crisis moment for Bernie Sanders and for their sort of larger intellectual project of socialism. And like a ton of anti-Warren content came out from the left at exactly the time she was facing sort of maximum peril from the right. And to an extent, I think you have to see the Warren campaign's now effort to like nuke Bernie on the verge of Iowa as, and some level, payback for that. That even though Bernie didn't personally sort of weigh into that in the same way, both of them have, in fact, for months now, approached this as a lanes game in which, like, the goal is to defeat Joe Biden, but the means through which you defeat Joe Biden is by tearing down the other progressive candidate. And it's something that makes a lot of progressive-minded people who I know feel very uncomfortable because, like, they like both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. They would prefer either of them to Biden. Biden, and they don't think this kind of fighting is like constructive politics. But I think narrowly, like it makes a lot of tactical sense.
Yeah, and there were, it should be said, it came out that there were talking points being distributed inside the Bernie campaign a few days before the story hit that were anti-Warren and were explaining, you know, in a quite normal primary way, how to talk people out of supporting Elizabeth Warren and into supporting Bernie Sanders. So there's some growing enmity in the campaigns. I think you're right to foreground this fact that the extremely online contingent of the Bernie sphere has been attacking Elizabeth Warren full on. I mean, talking here about folks like Jacobin, Nathan Robinson at Current Affairs, the assault on Warren as a professional managerial class snake has way predated this. And now they're all saying, you know, see, like she's really, but this is politics. And I want to make two points about this that are a bit bigger. One is that it is not the case that there is any reason to think a woman cannot win the presidency. There's actually a lot of research on women running for office in America. Jennifer Lawless at American University has done a lot of great work here. And it seems women often do a little bit better than men. Now, that might be some amount of Jackie Robinson effect, which women run and the difficulties of getting to that point. But in 2018, women candidates did extremely well. If you look at some of the key states, like, say, Wisconsin, you have Tammy Baldwin is an elected Democratic senator there and a woman. So there's no reason to think a woman can't win in 2020. And in general, I think it is almost bad to be having this conversation repeatedly because there is political science evidence suggesting that when you have this conversation, you actually cue people's, at this point, pretty unfounded fears that women can't win. So that's also one reason I'm a little skeptical that this was coming. I have no idea who leaked the story, but this would be, to me, a strange tactical decision for the Warren campaign at high levels to make. I would not be surprised at all if this is something that, say, these reporters had been hearing for a long time. It had been out there. They had been having a little bit of trouble confirming it. And then as people around Warren got more pissed at Bernie, somebody finally like gave them the true confirmation they needed. Sometimes stories don't come out in as tactical a way as it seems when you're reading them. Because one thing that Elizabeth Warren has very, very specifically not tried to do is run a kind of I'm with her candidacy, in part because I think they understand this evidence pretty well, that you want to be very careful on this. Rebecca Traister has a great piece over at The Cut about how dangerous and difficult it is for candidates from groups that have not traditionally won political power to talk honestly about the challenges they face. And she notes that Warren's campaign has handled this very delicately until now. And Warren's campaign did not seem ready for this to come out. Their initial set of answers were very halting and seemed surprised. So I'd be very curious to know the backstory on this, but I don't actually know it.
A sort of deeper part of the backstory of this that I do think is relevant is that in the specific context of like now, January 2019, to say a woman will face crippling disadvantages as the nominee is like understood as the anti-feminist position to take. But back in the winter of 2016, 2017, and I think throughout all of 2017, if I had said, I don't believe that Hillary Clinton's gender was a significant factor in her electoral defeat, that would have been received by the very same people who are most amped up about what Bernie allegedly did as like me being the bad misogynist. And like, how can I deny the evident reality that misogyny held Hillary back, right? And if you look at like Hillary's official account of what happened in a book literally titled What Happened, she very much foregrounds the idea that being a woman is what hurt her, right? Was like decisive in causing her to lose that election. And I wrote and said like several times at the time, like, I mean, I know a lot of the people who worked in Hillary World, and I know the depth and sincerity of their commitment to promoting women in American politics. And I was very vexed by their lack of consideration of like what the second order consequences of going with this narrative were going to be. And I just think, I think a lot of the Democratic electorate has responded in like a very predictable way to like the literal, like the literal words. I hate the phrase the establishment, but like the sort of post-Nova remnants of Hillary World really have clearly articulated the view that sexism was a crippling disadvantage for Hillary Clinton, and also that Donald Trump is a dangerous authoritarian whose existence in office is like an existential threat to American democracy. It is very logical conclusion from those two points to be like, I might like to see a woman be president, but I don't want to risk the future of the American Constitution over it. Let's go with Joe Biden. Let's go with Bernie Sanders. Let's go with whatever. And it honestly, as an argument, never really made sense to me. Like she says in her book that the criticism she took for her paid speaking engagements was an example of sexism. And like, I just don't think it was. Like anybody would get criticized by the left for doing a bunch of paid speeches for investment banks.
A couple things here. One is that a striking thing about this story, and it goes to exactly what you were just saying, about a week ago, Joe Biden said, and I'm quoting him a little bit from memory here, but I'm going to get this basically right. Hillary Clinton faced a lot of sexism in 2016. What happened to her was really, really unfair. They were really unfair to her. Well, folks, that's not going to happen to me.
Right.
And Biden, on the record, in public, voiced exactly the argument you're just saying, right, which is a logical set of conclusions based on the premises laid out, among others, by the Hillary Clinton campaign or post-campaign. It got a lot less attention than this behind closed doors weird thing, which is a general problem, I think, in political reporting and the way it gets responded to. Things that are putatively secret get a lot more attention than things candidates say in speeches. But Biden really said that. It was very clear what he meant. And while he didn't say a woman can't win, he did imply certainly that if you want to win, your best shot is with a white guy like Joe Biden, or at least a guy like Joe Biden. But I do want to make one point about misogyny in Hillary Clinton, because I think this is actually pretty complicated stuff. One is that it may be the case that women candidates on net don't do worse than male candidates, and they still face a lot of misogyny. And so you're seeing, among other things, composition effects, or that to be a woman candidate, you have to be better than a male candidate, right? Twice as good. So you're seeing it compensated for in other ways. But the other thing that I really do take seriously with Clinton, Hillary Clinton has been one of the most prominent women in American politics for going on 30 years. And one of the arguments she made in her book, and I think it is very true about her specifically, is that she has been through a lot of waves of different kinds of misogyny and different kinds of America coming to terms with the idea that there will be women in politics, and has paid a lot of different prices for that, has also had some benefits from that, right? She very aggressively foregrounded the idea that she was a woman, this would be historic, I'm with her. But nevertheless, I think that Hillary Clinton's view that public perceptions of her were extremely inflected by misogyny, going back to her comment in the Clinton White House that, you know, what did you want me to do? Stay home and bake cookies. And it created this national furor. You know, was she dismissing stay-at-home mothers? The idea that ideas of Clinton had been shaped over a long period in a pretty misogynistic context, and in many cases by quite misogynistic people, is another point Traister makes in terms of who's been dominating punditry and other things during that time. I don't think that's wrong. The situation Clinton is facing as somebody who's been in politics since the 80s, basically, with her or with Bill Clinton in Arkansas, and the situation a female politician who is just bursting onto the national stage in the last 5 or 6 years are facing are pretty different.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I just, one distinction that I think should be drawn is there's a difference between does a candidate face misogynistic criticism and is a candidate on net hurt by misogyny,
yes,
right? And I think one example is if you look at the research in JFK's campaign in 1960, it is obvious that, and you can clearly see, right? So he was Catholic. There had never been a Catholic president before. And he certainly received a criticism that was grounded in anti-Catholic bigotry. At the same time, the research on the 1960 campaign indicates that on net, he benefited from being Catholic, that he got super large Catholic turnout. And he did lose some votes to anti-Catholic prejudice, but he gained more than he lost. Then you also have research about Obama in 2008, where I think you see the opposite. He clearly gained some votes because he was African-American. He got the strongest black turnout of anybody ever. And Democrats now like wish they could go back to that. But he also lost white votes, right? And because white people so badly outnumber black people, that was like on net challenging for him, whereas white Catholics were very numerous in the population in 1960. Women is a very large group of people. It's not as potent a political identity as African-American, and that's sort of the tricky terrain that people grapple with. But I mean, when I think about Joe Biden's prospects as a general election candidate, I am really not persuaded that he will be a stronger candidate because he's a man. That, like, I actually think he will lose. That Hillary, I mean, Hillary has been, like, retconned as, like, the worst politician ever or something. But there were a large number of people who were very inspired by Hillary Clinton's quest for the presidency.
Or go watch her in a debate versus Joe Biden.
Right. I mean, not just she's a more skilled debater, I mean, which I think is true. But I mean, I just think on a grassroots level, even though Hillary Clinton's like policy platform was not particularly like amazing, and even though she's not a great poetic orator, what she stood for, right, what she represented meant an incredible amount to millions of people. There was the Pantsuit Nation Facebook group. There was all this stuff. And Biden is not going to be able to replicate that kind of pro-Biden mobilization. He's going to be just another like old politician with blah ideas. And maybe that's good because it won't turn certain kinds of people off. But I mean, I think there was a real, you know, identity is very complicated in politics. We'll talk about your book on another occasion. But like, you know, there's two sides to all of this. And I think it's telling that when phrased bluntly as like, let's not nominate a woman, people, I think, correctly take that to be like a bad stance for women to like assert that they face crippling obstacles in politics rather than difficulties that are surmountable. Like, it's hard to win a presidential election.
So I think all this is correct. And I'd really recommend people read Tracer's piece because I think it like limbs this difficulty very, very well. But OK, so what happens in the debate is this comes up. Bernie Sanders gives, I think, a pretty eloquent argument that this is not at the very least what he believes and argues that you can definitely win the presidency as a woman. He makes a point fairly, and to my knowledge, this is true, that in 2015 or 2014, maybe it was, he went to Elizabeth Warren to see if she was going to run for president, because if she was going to, he wasn't going to. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so he makes all these arguments. Elizabeth Warren does not rebut him or call him a liar, but just also does not say that what he is saying is true, and makes an argument about how both her and Amy Klobuchar have better electoral records than the men on the stage. Then at the end of the debate, when the cameras are still on, but nobody's able to hear what people are saying, there's this now very viral moment where Warren walks up to Sanders and Sanders has his like hand out, but Warren clasps her hands in front of her. So Sanders retracts his hand and then they have what looks like a somewhat heated, quick discussion where he points at her and then he walks away. We don't know what happened. Only Tom Steyer knows what happened because he was nearby and has refused to say. The point I want to make about this is not that I think they said anything all that interesting to each other in that exchange, but that here we are. This is the last presidential primary debate before Iowa. And what happened last night is Joe Biden, who I thought had a particularly bad night as a debater, seemed very low energy, was not giving very clear answers. He skated by completely. Nobody really took him on. And there had been a bunch of signals both from Bernie and Warren that they were preparing a big anti-Biden argument for this debate. Warren had brought out this new bankruptcy plan. Joe Biden had begun talking about how Bernie Sanders had begun talking about how Biden was going to blow the election given what he's done on Social Security and the Iraq War. And aside from a very minor dust up over the Iraq War, the story of that debate is that Bernie and Warren were fighting with each other, and it is not that either of them took apart Joe Biden, or that Joe Biden was facing fire all night from the two of them, or even anything that Joe Biden said himself. And so if in a couple of weeks what happens is that Joe Biden wins Iowa, as is currently seen at least in some polls, although not the Des Moines Register poll that just came out, I think this is going to be seen in retrospect as like a complete political debacle for the left.
Yes. Should we take a break and then talk about the substance of some of those attacks that didn't actually come forward?
Sure.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. All too often, people like the owl monkey and the Australian sea lion only see the world in black or white. Now, regular listeners of this podcast, who are mostly humans, understand that the world is more complicated than that. There's also plenty of gray areas. The world of business is a great example. See what I did there? An S&P 500 company and a small business owner have to see things differently, which is why NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for any business. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system that brings accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into a single platform. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which can reduce IT costs and can improve efficiency and cut back on mistakes by bringing all your major business processes into one platform. NetSuite says that more than 37,000 companies have already made the move. Maybe it's time you did the same. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area.
Support for the show comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes, buy all the stocks in a theme as is, or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
Support for this show comes from Mercury. Financial operations are needlessly complex. Startups have to cobble together a patchwork of tools to reconcile transactions from different sources and struggle to glean answers from platforms that speak different languages. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so you can pay bills faster, stay in control of company spending, and speed up reconciliation. Apply in minutes at mercury.com and join over 100,000 ambitious startups that trust Mercury, not just for banking and credit cards, but for the precision, control, and focus they need to transform their financial workflows and perform at their best. Mercury, the art of simplified finances. Apply in minutes at mercury.com. Mercury is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group and Evolve Bank & Trust. Members FDIC.
This was like a truly weird media moment because like there was a Politico story that was like, get ready for Bernie Sanders' attacks on Joe Biden. And it like laid out.
And there was Bernie Sanders on TV making attacks on Joe Biden. It wasn't just an anonymous Politico story.
Right. It was like good. It was well reported. But it was like Bernie said some stuff on TV. And then there was this Politico article that like fleshed it out in more detail. And then there were like stories in The Intercept and you know, like other like Bernie-friendly media, like fully laying this out. And the basics of it were that like, look, Joe Biden has this electability pitch, but we're going to let Donald Trump say in the Midwestern swing states, here's a guy who was for Iraq. I was against it, which is not really true, but it's something Trump says. Joe Biden wants to cut your Social Security benefits. And Joe Biden was the champion of NAFTA and Trans-Pacific Partnership. And like, this is going to be an electoral fiasco. And also, it's substantively wrong. And like, Bernie has now in every single debate kind of like needled Biden about Iraq. And then Biden has his not really accurate stock response where he's like, aha, Bush tricked me.
Well, then he also says, and then Barack Obama turned to me and he told me to end the Iraq war, which is just a genuinely weird reframing of what happened there.
Yes. Right. But like Bernie didn't – what had been previewed was that Bernie was going to go from like, here's a hit on Joe Biden to like, here's my point about Joe Biden. It just didn't happen. And then Warren put out a plan to change bankruptcy law, which references big changes to bankruptcy law that happened in 2005 that Biden was the major sponsor of. Obviously, nobody in the electorate is like voting on bankruptcy bill reform in 2020. The point of this pretty clearly was to cue up a contrast with Joe Biden. The big picture in Warren's proposal is to make it easier for people who have unsecured debts to just sort of walk away from them in bankruptcy, which I think is a good idea. But there's also this like little laundry list of like weird line items. So it's like you can still pay your union dues even when you're in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy resolution process. And you're reading this, any normal person would be like, what the fuck is this stuff, right? What it is all of those laundry list items, they are specific poison pill amendments that Democrats brought into committee in the 2005 bankruptcy reform process that Joe Biden voted against all of them because he was part of the mostly GOP-led coalition to get this bill done. And what Biden's campaign says, if you ask them about this bankruptcy bill, is like, look, this was going to pass. Biden kind of got on the bus and he was able to make changes to make the bill better. And Warren was setting up the point that like, no, Democrats offered like this laundry list of amendments that would have improved the bill and Biden helped beat them all back. But then she didn't say any of that. So like, what's the point?
It's like, and I think it's a important to say here, this is not an attack that Elizabeth Warren has come up with in the year of our Lord 2020. During that period, what Warren was a specialist in bankruptcy law. And she was, as an academic who had written in 2004 this book, The Two-Income Trap, she attacks Biden in that book for his work on bankruptcy reform and actually attacks him in a very, very specific way where she says Joe Biden goes around the country framing himself as an advocate for women because of his work on the Violence Against Women Act. And here he is making it harder for women to declare bankruptcy and making it more likely that women are going to end up in poverty and under crushing debt. And you cannot support women in this one way and then destroy them in another. We've been at Vox doing this series where we're making the best case possible for the leading Democratic candidates. Matt had a great one on Bernie. I did the Warren one and it came out this week. And when I was talking to people around Warren, I heard something which I've heard before, which is Elizabeth Warren's formative political experience is the bankruptcy law fight, and it was shattering for her. Like, she loses, and the person she loses to specifically is Joe Biden. And so this goes way back, and Elizabeth Warren's whole worldview on economic policy is built on the foundation of what she learned in bankruptcy law and contract law around that. And she's been building out a view of how unfairly the American economy treats the powerless versus the powerful, built on that foundation for a long time. Joe Biden represents to her the ways in which the American economy and the Democratic Party has made not just its peace with that, but has been a handmaiden of a lot of this rigging of the economy against people. This is the core of Warren's politics, like the molten core of her politics. She then brings out, as you say, this new proposal this week, and then just does nothing with it. It is bizarre. And she needs a moment. I mean, she's running, you know, roughly third in the primary. Like she needs a couple points. She like needs to shake up the situation.
And you know, and I thought she did fairly well in the debate.
Yeah,
she's always a good public speaker. But wait, what's striking about this? I mean, is this really is like her origin as a politician. Like if you want to understand why this law professor is now a senator and running for president, it's because as a law professor, she was engaged for years, like part-time, but like 4 years in an effort to defeat this bankruptcy legislation. It went through, I mean, I wrote an article about this. You can look it up. But it went through many iterations across two presidencies. It took a long time. She ultimately lost, and she changed her focus, and she broadened it out from thinking about bankruptcy specifically to thinking about corruption in the political system, all the themes that she mentioned, right? But she didn't tie it back to this thing that is both the focus of her academic career and also like literally was a battle with the front runner for the presidency. And it's frustrating to me as a person who followed this bankruptcy debate at the time in 2005 and like wants to write articles about it. But it also just like it doesn't to me make sense on the level of logic and pairing together, right, like both the critiques that Sanders telegraphed and didn't make and the ones that Warren telegraphed and didn't make. Like to me, as somebody who did not write the case for Joe Biden when we were dealing out these assignments, like my—
Which is coming, I want to say. We will have the case for Joe Biden.
There will be one. But it speaks to like what is my actual concern with Joe Biden, because I totally acknowledge that like the main things Biden says on behalf of himself, like he does well in head-to-head polls against Donald Trump, like that's very true. And also that these like more out there, like progressive ideas that like Warren and Bernie are allegedly going to deliver aren't really going to happen. That's also right. I mean, but Biden's, he's got a good team and he says, I think, a lot of totally reasonable and true things about the world. But he has this like really unfortunate track record of signing on to bipartisan ideas that are bad, I think.
Yes.
You know, and like he talks about like I'm going to be able to work with Republicans. And a lot of people dismiss that. And they're like, that's crazy. Like Republicans will never agree to anything. But like I worry more the opposite. I mean, you know, good. Like try to work with Republicans. Right. And if they slap your hand away, they slap your hand away. But Biden really has worked with Republicans on things like a resolution authorizing the invasion of Iraq and a bankruptcy reform bill that was bad for the middle class and on sequestration legislation that like crippled the American economy. And that to me, like it's a real record of achievement, but like it's not good. Like that's not where you're not just like supposed to make the system work like just for the heck of it.
Well, so this is, I think, actually an interesting space. Two things. One is that on the political game theoretic level, a view has taken hold among different players that the Democratic electorate punishes people who go on the attack in these primaries. And so in particular, this is a bit of a bind for Warren and Bernie, because the theory is that if any one of them like really rushed Joe Biden, the electorate that might listen to them, but it would go to the other one of them, right? There's like somebody who's too good of a substitute for them on that stage. And so that like they see an attack on Joe Biden, like a frontal attack, as potentially a murder-suicide. There's not very good evidence for this, in my view. You had actually mentioned this. I think that Ian Sams, the former comms director for Kamala Harris, notes that Harris jumped in the polls after attacking Biden, that she was not able to sustain it because she did not like have anything to say after her initial attack and did not herself want to bring back busing. But it worked for her for a minute. Pete Buttigieg jumped in the polls, certainly in Iowa and New Hampshire, after going on the attack from sort of the moderate lane against Warren. So I don't really see where this view comes from, but it has taken quite sharp hold.
And, also, they attacked each other. So
yeah, well, that happened too. So then the other thing, though, that I want to say here on Biden. So I've helped with the reporting for the case for Biden, just talking to some people around Biden. And this is a thing that I am struck by. I have a lot of concerns watching the debates about whether or not Joe Biden is actually up to the job of the presidency, to just say this very flatly. But one thing that he does not do in these debates is make an argument for his brand of politics and make an argument for why he was right about things, which is what he used to do. Like, if you look at old clips of Joe Biden, it is not the case the controversies around him are new, but he used to argue for his position with a lot of force. And so at the debate, what you see is Bernie Sanders attacks Biden on Iraq, and Joe Biden says, well, that was a mistake. I was wrong. But then, you know, Barack Obama turned to me to personally get every troop out of Iraq. What Joe Biden doesn't do, which I think is what he would have done a couple of years ago, is say Bernie Sanders has been anti-interventionist at every level in every question in American politics, more or less for years, with maybe the exception of the Afghanistan war. And he's wrong that we actually need to be global leaders, that there are times when we do need to intervene. There are great moments in American history like Kosovo. Some of the mistakes we've made, like Rwanda, have to do with being too anti-interventionist. And we need somebody who's going to step into to America's role in the world. That's what he would have said before. And similarly here, when I talk to people around Biden, they make the point that this is actually very core to his politics, that that a difference between him and the left lane is that when the left lane looks at these deals that get struck, they focus on what is bad in them, and Joe Biden focuses on what is good in them. The fiscal cliff deal is the big example of this. So the Bush tax cuts were expiring because they had this 10-year expiration date so they could fit into budget reconciliation rules. So under Obama, there's all of a sudden this huge tax increase coming, and there are these negotiations with Republicans to do something about it. Biden ends up negotiating out a deal with Mitch McConnell, and I'm going to get the specifics of it a little bit wrong from memory, but basically he extends all but the tax cuts for the very, very, very richest, and in some cases tax cuts for the very richest. But he gets a bunch of tax cuts and EITC kind of things for the working class. So here's a deal that basically Republicans get a lot of what they want, but Democrats get a lot of things they want too. And Joe Biden and the people around Joe Biden say that was a good deal. It mattered more that we were able to help the poor than that we like screwed rich people on the estate tax. And other people say, no, you either could have gotten a better deal by just letting the fiscal cliff expire and then using that as leverage, the tax increase as leverage, or this just wasn't a deal worth taking at all. Biden just disagrees. But the thing you do not see him doing anymore is making a case for those disagreements. Like, Joe Biden is a deal maker. Joe Biden thinks the left is gripped by purity politics. And Joe Biden thinks it is better to get like a quarter loaf. And not just like, I almost think that's maybe the wrong metaphor. He thinks it is better to accept some things you really don't like to get some things you really do, because that is how the American political system works. And it's more important to help people than to like feel good about, you know, not helping the people you don't like. But you never hear that from him on the stage.
Yeah. Although I want to drill down into this fiscal cliff thing because it's seared into my memory. And, you know, it's, I think, important to understand that on that particular topic, Biden's critics are not just like the far left of the party. Back when Michael Bennett was still managing to get into debates, like, he raised this, right? And he said, arguing with Biden about this, he said, the deal with Mitch McConnell was a complete victory for the Tea Party. We've been running against this for 10 years. We've lost that economic argument because that deal extended almost all these Bush tax cuts permanently and put in place the mindless cuts we're still dealing with today that are called the sequester. That was a great deal for Mitch McConnell and a terrible deal for America. Now, like, maybe Bennett is wrong, but like, Bennett is not like the
Harry Reid was furious.
The
about
left
this
of the
deal.
Democratic Party, right? And like, Harry Reid was really mad about the deal.
He threw it into a fire.
Right.
Like, there was a fire, but like, famously, he took the deal that it was like the paper and at some point threw it into the fireplace.
Right. And I think one of the reasons why there are such strong feelings about this that don't follow like super clear ideological lines is that part of the issue there was like, exactly how hardcore should Democrats be in their negotiating tactics? Right? That like, Biden's point is, if you look at the terms of this deal, we won some things that were good. Reid's point is that had they just sucked it up and let the Bush tax cuts fully expire, they would have had a much stronger negotiating position. And then I think Biden's counter to that, It's not like Joe Biden just did this rogue. I mean, he was vice president. The counter to that, not just from Joe Biden, but from the people in the Obama administration who agreed with this approach, was that, like, it would be too crazy and chaotic to have this, like, giant tax increase come in January 1st and then argue for 5 months about exactly how much of it to roll back with Democrats, like, posturing sort of Tea Party style, like, we're not going to give you anything, right? That would just be not like a not a good way to run the government, right? And Biden's approach, like, make a deal before the deadline, make a deal that advances some goals of both people, shake hands, have a nice press conference, like, do a signing ceremony. That's how politics should be done. That's functioning governance in the United States of America. And you've written before about, like, Biden has this profound belief in the system, that the system works and that he can make it work, but also that you have an obligation to do that, to not do what Harry Reid wanted to do there and, like, let things get a little bit loopy just because it would have given Democrats more leverage. And to me, that theory smacks to me less of pragmatism than of unilateral surrender. It reminds me of Pat Leahy bringing back the blue slip rule when Democrats had a majority in the Senate, just so that Republicans could get rid of it again once they had a majority. We're like, you can make a case for the blue slip rule, but, like, what the old bulls of the Democratic Senate caucus were doing there, like, just fuck them over for no reason. It didn't entrench the rule. It just yanked the football away. And, like, this is what I really worry about with Biden.
I would not call it unilateral surrender. He made a deal, right? He got things, and the Obama administration got things that they wanted. And I will say a little bit more to their in their defense on this. I was covering this at the time. And the argument that people were making was that if you look at the Democratic Senate caucus, the key players here are going to last exactly 6 seconds after these tax cuts take hold. Like, the Democrats who are – I don't remember exactly who the swing Democrats were and, like, who lost in 2014 versus who lost in 2016. But you're looking at, like, your Joe Donnelly's, you know, tester, that kind of person. And that as soon as those tax cuts go up, the idea that they are going to be more united in the majority than Republicans are going to be in the minority was just ridiculous, and that they were going to get a worse deal pretty soon and take a lot of political damage. The thing I want to say about this, because I do think it's actually interesting, is that I wish people were having this argument more centrally, and specifically I wish Joe Biden was having this argument more centrally, because this is a way in which I think these presidencies really would be different. So when I think about what's going to happen here with the different candidates, I think you've got, like, a couple different questions. So one, the single biggest question about how legislatively successful the next Democratic president will be is how many Senate seats get picked up down ballot from them. And an argument the Biden people make, which I think has actually some validity to it, but it depends how much you think it would hold in an ongoing way, is that right now, if you ask, like, the Democrats running for Senate in Arizona, in North Carolina, in Iowa, in Alabama, like, which candidate do they want to win the Democratic nomination? They will say Joe Biden. Like, no doubt about it. Like, socialism is not a popular word in Arizona or Alabama, but, like, Democrats, like, would like to keep that Doug Jones seat. And so that's one thing.
I think that's a good argument. Like,
I think it's a very good argument.
Bernie and Warren didn't do their best arguments against Biden, and Biden didn't make his best argument for himself, is that one.
So then you get into the next question of electability. And again, I don't know how to think about – Joe Biden has been more robust in the face of criticisms I find convincing. And so that may just hold through the entire general election. But so people can argue about electability. But currently, despite – the criticisms of him getting a lot of play and the whole thing about his son being at the center of the impeachment scandal, nevertheless, he's held the top position against Trump in head-to-head polling. So there's electability. And then you get into this issue, though. If you net all that out, if you believe that Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders would be exactly as electable and hold as many Senate seats as Joe Biden, which I think is reasonable, you could at least make that argument. Then you get into this question, like, well, what would their presidencies look like? And this is a way in which I think they would really look different. I think it is possible, actually, that Joe Biden would get more done than Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, because Republicans will hold quite a bit of power in the Senate, whether it's a majority or not. And what Joe Biden is going to do is cut more deals. And so he's going to get somewhat more things done that Democrats will like. And as the cost of that, he will accept a larger number of things getting done that Democrats really, really, really hate. And that is a different nature to it. Like, Bernie Sanders will say no to those deals. He won't get the things he wants in them, but he won't get the things he doesn't want in them either. And not everything has a fiscal cliff dimension to it, where there's some kind of external leverage that is going to fuck everything up if you don't make a deal. So a lot of things are just going to be, do you want to cut this deal or not? Joe Biden was behind this Cures Act a couple of years ago. And the Cures Act had a bunch of things going on in it. To be honest, I haven't studied it super closely, but it passed 95-5 in the Senate. And in that five who voted against it were Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And so this was a deal that had a lot of money for cancer research, which is why Biden cared deeply about it. It had a lot of other things that people felt were giveaways to pharma, which is why Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren didn't like it. And Joe Biden feels like that was worth it. And like, look at the vote. You can see it was worth it. And they feel, no, it wasn't worth it because we gave more to pharma than we should have. And you shouldn't do that anymore. And this is a way in which like, these are going to be different presidencies, even in the context of Republicans having a lot of power.
And I think another thing that's worth mentioning in that regard, because I feel like a lot of people don't necessarily remember anything in politics that happened before 2015.
Was there even politics before 2015?
Yes. And also, Biden doesn't bring this up because it doesn't serve his tactical interests. But like when Barack Obama was president, there was a non-trivial number of Democrats who at various points in time felt that he should have been more willing than he was to make concessions to Republicans to go get things done. Obviously, opinions changed from time to time on different specific circumstances, but I think that both Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton were generally associated with that camp. That I think one specific thing is that people kept floating the idea of doing a corporate income tax repatriation holiday, which is like a kind of goofy accounting gimmick.
No, real quick, what it basically just means is that if you bring back money that you're holding overseas for in a limited period of time, you basically don't pay taxes on it. You get like a get out of jail free card in this money you've been holding in Ireland.
What they would give you is a discount tax rate, right?
Yes.
So it would be a tax cut that scores as a revenue raiser.
Yes.
And so this idea kept kicking around that you could do this and then you could use the revenue to do an infrastructure bill.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Obama's economic team just like really hated this idea. Like they found it to be offensive. I think it really bothered them in their wonk souls that you would enact a tax cut and score it as a tax increase.
Well, no. What their argument was that money is leverage for a better corporate tax reform later. And
right.
If you do this, you lose all of that leverage all at once for something very small.
Right. And the case for doing it, which I know Bill Clinton made vocally, and you know you hear things around the way, was look, if we do this, we will get the infrastructure done, which like is good on its own terms. Infrastructure is good. The building trade unions will like it because they like the jobs. The economy could use the stimulus. The bigger deficit that results in the long term is not a big deal because sort of who cares? And people will like it that you did something bipartisan and got something done. Now, Obama held the line on that in a way that I think Joe Biden maybe wouldn't have, that Hillary Clinton maybe wouldn't have. And the upshot of Obama holding the line on it was not that it created leverage for a better corporate tax reform down the road. It's that Trump used it as a pay-for, not as a pay-for to do an infrastructure bill, but he did a tax cut that scores as a revenue raiser, and he used that to offset the costs of more tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So like in that case, I think in retrospect, the criticism of the Obama administration was vindicated and that like rejecting a deal that was on the table in favor of some hypothetical like better idea just led to a worse idea, right? And again, for very obvious reasons, Joe Biden is not going to stand up there and criticize Barack Obama's decision making and say that he would do a better job than the patron saint of his campaign. But like to me, as somebody who's around there, like I think that's a topic in which like his stance has been vindicated and that thinking more like a politician and less like a PhD economist is beneficial, that like ultimately politics is politics and like trying to do things in the here and now has some real benefits because inevitably you win some elections, you lose some elections, and like you kind of got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, but I don't know that I quite buy that. I only in this one sense, which is that the reason that it didn't work out is that Donald Trump won the next election. And if they had been planning all of their like political strategy on Donald Trump will win the next election, just a lot of things look different. But if Hillary Clinton had won the next election, or Joe Biden had run and won the next election, or Elizabeth Warren, then you'd be glad you didn't sell down that corporate repatriation. I would just say the big picture here on Biden is that he will make these deals. Biden has a very coherent theory of politics, I will say. And I will put it in show notes, but I wrote a piece a while back called Joe Biden Will Never Give Up on the System. And it was tagged a bit to when he was praising segregation to senators. But Joe Biden has really like lived his life, not just his professional life, but his life in the Senate. It's a different thing for him. When he came to the Senate, his wife and child were killed in a terrible car crash. He was sworn in at the hospital bed of his sons. The way the Senate has acted for him as a family and as a proving ground, he's had a bunch of different crises. He had multiple brain aneurysms. He was brought through by his own people. I go through this in pretty deep detail. He loves the Senate. He loves the way it works. And the other thing that is a connected criticism to the one you were just bringing up against Obama, Matt, is that there was also this criticism that Barack Obama did not invest the time in creating legislative relationships. Mm. And this was just constant, that he didn't hang out and have senators over to watch football games. He didn't. There's this famous line from one of Obama's White House correspondent dinner speeches where Obama says, "People keep telling me to go have a drink with Mitch McConnell." Well, you have a drink with Mitch McConnell, which was a joke, but not in any way a joke, right? The last thing Barack Obama wanted to do was hang out with Mitch McConnell. And this was understood at the time correctly as a criticism that Joe Biden believed and sort of comes even in part from Joe Biden world, which is that Joe Biden was often deployed to do that relational work that Barack Obama didn't want to do. Now, the reason I bring this up here is that this is also a big difference between the Biden, Bernie, and Warren campaigns, where Bernie Sanders is known as one of the true like lone wolf personality types in the Senate. Usually the people who get to that level of politics are like maniacal, extroverted backslappers who like can't live without constant approval coming into them from all directions. And Bernie Sanders was known for having actually very few close relationships in the Senate. He would work with people sometimes, but he's not a relationship builder. He just isn't. He actually, I think, said in this New York Times interview, if I'm not misremembering the interview, where he's like, you know, what's something you do poorly? And he said, well, I don't wish people a happy birthday because I don't think it matters.
Right.
And people really like it when you wish them happy birthday, but I don't know. I'm just like not good at that kind of thing. So like he won't even wish people happy birthday routinely on his campaign. Elizabeth Warren, you know, does do more coalitional work in the Senate than Bernie Sanders. Like you can actually see this in like the number of co-sponsors they have in bills and things, but still is not known for her great cross-party, cross-aisle relationship. She's got, you know, she does some odd bedfellows coalitions, but not much. Joe Biden, to the extent he's still doing this kind of thing, he really would sit around hanging out a lot with, you know, if she wins re-election to Susan Collins. And what that might get you is more deals that Joe Biden might think are good and the left would think are bad.
Right.
And I want to keep emphasizing this because this is a debate they are not having. But the difference between their presidencies is not really going to be that Joe Biden passes the Biden option on healthcare or Bernie Sanders passes a single-payer bill. It's that day-to-day, the way they're going to try to pass things is functionally going to be sort of bipartisan or partisan. And that probably will mean that, you know, at least in the Senates that seem likeliest, which most of them have Mitch McConnell as majority leader, Joe Biden gets some things done, but those things often don't look that good to the left. Whereas Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren are going to focus a lot more on aggressive use of executive authority. One other point I want to make on this is just this week, Warren came out with almost an update to her student debt cancellation plans, where she picked up on an idea that's been floating around. The American Prospect had a piece on it a little while back. There's a pretty, I would say, controversial legal theory that you can cancel student debt, almost all of it, just through executive authority, through reading expansively something that is already in the law. And she kind of picked that up and said I would do it. And the reason I bring this up is that when I was talking to Warren's people and people around her for this piece I did on the case for her, something they argued was that a mistake that they felt Barack Obama made was he often held regulatory authority in abeyance as a kind of stick in trying to get legislation done. So he wanted to get the cap and trade bill passed, but if he didn't get that, he would use EPA authority to regulate you know, carbon from power plants. And they felt he had that backwards, that what he wanted to do was aggressively use executive authority to change the facts on the ground so that now corporations are screaming for relief. They desperately want legislators to come in and help them. And they use the example, say, of in a case where they think actually Obama did this well, different states began legalizing marijuana. The Obama administration decided to use executive authority not to prosecute in those states. And that created a lot more room for marijuana legalization to begin at least get put on bills in the U.S. Senate and elsewhere because there were already facts on the ground. So I think of the student debt cancellation thing that Warren wants to do as very connected to her theory of legislating too. It may be that that wouldn't hold up in the courts, but even the fear that it would might make a lot of these different players from student loan companies, even up to Republicans, you know, at least in theory, come to the table to try to get a more moderate legislative solution.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is definitely – I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you ask anybody, right? It's like, what is the actual difference here, right? And this is a critical difference, right? It's like, who will be appointed to lead executive branch agencies and what is their theory of what you should do? And like, clearly, very clearly, like Warren Camp's theory is like, you go to the mats, right? And like, you lose cases in court. And that basically, if the courts aren't ever telling you, like, no, you can't do that, that just shows you're not trying hard enough. Among other things, like, most of the judges are Republican appointees. And, you know, it's just like that's life, right? And that you can do a lot that way. And I think, you know, Obama's view, I think there's a lot of levels to the Obama team's disagreement with that. But, like, really one of them is that the Obama administration put a high premium on trying to make it seem like things were like going okay in America. And in part, this was they took over in the midst of a very chaotic economic crisis. But like they wanted the opposite of what you have in the Trump era, which is like a constant sense of roiling chaos. And, you know, Warren or Sanders would be very different from Donald Trump, but I do think would be somewhat comparable in creating a sense of freneticness and like a lot of like, oh my God, can they really do that? And like litigation and people complaining. And because Democrats are more diverse internally in terms of like what goals they want to pursue, you would see more intra-party infighting around all of these things, right? Like if you do the strictest possible environmental regulations, like Joe Manchin is going to complain about that. And you're going to have stories about like Democrats are yelling at the Democratic president, right? And it's going to be, I think in a lot of ways, some bad looks. And like part of the Warren theory is that like you got to push through that. And that's ultimately how you're going to get things done for people. And deliver, you know, big structural change or what have you. And I think Biden, you know, would be much more likely to, in the same mold as Obama, if anything, even more so, to be like, you know, concerned about appearances, right? And like showing that he's not like abusing his authority or constantly losing Supreme Court cases about what he can do for people and like not that interested in giving like table pounding accounts of all the things other people are preventing him from getting done, right? That he wants to have sort of like feel good moments like that Cures Act, right? Where like even if some of the details of it are ugly, like the basic picture of a 95-5 vote is like, that's really good, right? That makes people feel like Congress is working and things are getting done and people are agreeing. And this is something you hear from people all the time, right? It's like, why are these politicians always arguing? Like, why can't they come together and get things done? And, you know, Warren's approach, a lot of things will occur if you take her approach, but it's not going to feel to people like getting things done. It's going to feel like the mess in Washington.
I think that's right. But it would be good to hear the weeds, I think, did a good job today of actually talking about the front runner. But it would be good to hear Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders making some of these arguments at debates and hear how Biden answers. I do think there's a constantly funny dynamic, the debates where Warren or Biden will say something and it won't make a lot of sense. And then Pete Buttigieg will say the thing that is actually what Biden is saying. And Pete Buttigieg last night was the one who made, I think, a reasonably eloquent argument for taking deals that aren't everything you want. There was a kind of quick debate over the the new trade deal. And Pete Buttigieg, I thought, like, had a reasonably eloquent argument for why you take that versus, like, Bernie Sanders, who did not want to take that. But Joe Biden continues to not make a very strong case for his own brand of politics. And yet he maintains his lead in the polls. So I guess we will see. Maybe he doesn't need to. Maybe it'll only be bad for him to actually argue for his brand of politics.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, I do think it would be. I mean, I think that I would like to see, like, a crisper, like, more focused kind of debate on these things. But it is definitely true that, like, whatever Biden is doing, it does seem to be working for him, right? And that getting into a higher level of granularity about anything does just, like, run the risk of making somebody hear it and be like, oh, no, wait, I don't agree with that. Whereas currently, it's like just most Democrats are favorably disposed to Joe Biden.
I think that's – do you believe the Des Moines Register poll or the Monmouth poll, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you don't know.
Because the early states, he's weakening a little bit more potentially.
Yes.
And or maybe not.
I mean, one question is, like, is Biden weaker in the early states than nationally because those people have seen more and, mm-hmm. like, thought in more detail about it? Or is it just that there's fewer black people in those states?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you to Matt Iglesias for being here. Thank you to Cynthia Gill for engineering, to Jeffrey Geld for producing, to Virgin Karma for researching. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production.
Support for this show comes from Mercury. There's an art to making the complex feel simple. Everything should be in sync so that even the smallest part serves a bigger purpose. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so ambitious companies have the precision, control, and focus they need to perform at their best. Apply in minutes at mercury.com.